You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 93. Nobody Knows Anything. William Goldman.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Now, guys, today on the show, we have screenwriter and script doctor John Winston Rainey. John is the co-author, along with legendary script consultant Linda Seeger, of the book You Talking to Me? How to Write Great Dialogue. And John has written over 25 scripts, which three of them have been produced, and has had 10 of them optioned. He's been a script consultant since 1989, and he is also the author of Screenwriting Style That Sizzles, a primer for polishing. Now, I wanted to have John on the show to talk all about character and creating memorable characters, as well as every other part of the screenwriting process. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with John Winston Rainey. I'd like to welcome to the show John Winston Rainey. How are you doing, John?
Doing well. How are you doing, Alex?
As good as we can be in this crazy upside down world that we live in today.
Upside down. It's very upside down.
I feel like we are in the upside down like Stranger Things. Like, I keep telling people that I feel like we honestly are in Back to the Future 2 in the alternative timeline where Biff runs.
Alternative dimension, yeah.
Yes, where Biff runs the world. Yes, it's just... It's an insane world. I mean, there's a meteor coming now, and
night before the election.
Yes, obviously, because the universe has a sense of irony.
Well, we are going through a massive transition from the third dimension through the fourth dimension to the fifth dimension.
Obviously,
everything is becoming energy, less matter, and more energy. So we have to become acclimated to that. That's why we are quarantining ourselves so that we can become self-sufficient mentally and emotionally without having to go out and grab and push and shove for our living.
Well, man, I there's definitely something happening. There's no question about it. I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime.
Dude, it's very quantum.
Very, very quantum. So let's talk a little bit about screenwriting and that process. But before we do, how did you get into the business?
So it was in the late 80s sometime. And this young lady told me she didn't want to see me again. And instead of this was over a Thanksgiving weekend. And I thought, instead of crying in my beer, I'm going to sit down this weekend and write a screenplay. I did. And I wrote it longhand on legal pads because I didn't have a computer back then. And of course I have a huge background in acting and directing. And so, you know, like I kind of knew what dramatic art was all about. Mm-hmm. And a friend of a friend of mine knew Ken Rotkop, and we got the script to him. He read it. He said, "Yeah, John, come on down." And so I was in his workshop for 4 years. I wasn't in there 6 weeks when he asked me to be his associate, which means the gopher, you know. But he loved my writing and did all the way up to the day he died, actually. He passed away this past year, unfortunately. But anyway, yeah, so I wrote that screenplay. That first screenplay got optioned. actually, and by Bill Duke.
I know Bill. Bill's a good guy.
Yeah, very good guy, and really, really super intelligent, too.
Very smart guy. Very smart guy.
Yeah, yeah. And so I went through a development process with him on that very first screenplay, and went to school there. But before then, I'd been a big fan of the dramatic arts, but also Joseph Campbell.
Of course.
And, I read Hero with a Thousand Faces back in God, I don't want to tell you when, because then you know exactly how old I am. but it was a long time ago. And it was extracurricular reading, you know. I just read it because it was there.
It sounded interesting.
Well, a professor that I knew recommended it, and so he wanted me to read it so we could discuss it. And so I knew about Hero with a Thousand Faces before George Lucas started touting it.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you're giving me a little bit of your age there just by saying that. Now, I wanted to ask you in regards to the hero's journey, because the hero's journey has been, I mean, abused in Hollywood now for
very, very, very abused
for decades now. And it has been kind of set up as like that is the only way to tell a story, and that is the only story, and everything falls into that story. Where I know by my own experiences and working and speaking to other people on the show that the hero's journey isn't the end all be all. It is one, and it has a lot of elements to it. But can you talk a little bit about that? Because I always use the example of like, if you throw the hero's journey on the detective story, it generally does not work.
It doesn't, because the detective, unless the detective has some inner issue that needs to be resolved before you can solve the case, because your theme really comes from, theme has two aspects to it. And I'm getting a little off the subject because, mm-hmm. You have your conceptual thematic things like racism. People call that a theme. Well, it's not really a theme as much as it's subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the theme would be, how does a racist, you know, like take the Defiant Ones, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, a black man, white man chained together, trying to escape the law. And they hate each other primarily because they're conditioned to hate by virtue of skin color. And right. That's it, period. And over the course of the movie, the story, they realize they have to depend on each other, and they come to respect each other. So that inner journey is really the theme, coming to respect, you know, all things, all life, or what is considered the other. The subject matter is racism. So it's really two different aspects. But back to the hero's journey, you know, Aristotle said, you know, he said, you know, there's every story has a beginning, middle, and end. And then Jean-Luc Godard comes along and says, well, yeah, every story has a beginning, middle, and end, but not necessarily in that order.
Right.
And so you take a look at momentum, and you say, okay, so how was that structured? Where's the beginning, middle, and end? It's there. But you you take a look at traffic. You know, there are five different stories to traffic.
Right.
And each one has their own structure.
Right. Pulp Fiction. So, all right.
Pulp Fiction, same thing. Pulp Fiction has three different structures, but the stories are just intertwined. And as Jean-Luc Godard says, you know, the end is sometimes the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's another great movie that I like even more than Pulp Fiction is called Before the Rain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Macedonian film written and directed by a photographer, and I can't pronounce his name, Milcho something or other. But it's a brilliant, brilliant movie that came out a year before Pulp Fiction, and it does the same thing. The theme to that is the circle is not round. I mean, it's just so beautiful because he does that structurally. He shows that structurally as well as thematically. I mean, as well as the character arc. So anyway, I don't know. And so, I don't think I'm answering your story.
I just wanted to kind of, you know, bring it to the audience, the question, because a lot of, especially young filmmakers, young screenwriters, when they're starting out, you know, they read The Hero's Journey or Chris Vogler's book, The Writer's Journey, which are amazing books, but not every story needs to fit in that. So if you take a standard Sir Arthur Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes story, which Sherlock generally doesn't,
He never changes. He's a James Bond type character. James Bond doesn't change. Ethan Hawke in Mission Impossible, they don't change. The only James Bond movie that actually worked for me in that way was Casino Royale.
Yeah, but he changed. He changes in that movie. Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. Yeah. He's got an arc. He has a character arc. The rest of them, you know, they get boring after a while.
Yeah, it's just a guy, you know, womanizing and shooting things.
You know, I think for me, actually, and this is going to shock a lot of people, one of the most boring films that I've ever watched was The Hangover. Because, a lot happens and nothing changes, you know, in that movie.
The characters,
They have a really nice Mercedes going to Las Vegas. They come back with a beat to shit Mercedes, and and they find the guy. You know, so they succeed in their quest, but what do they learn? Now, I've had to come to terms with this, Alex. I because for me, there's no real point in telling a story unless you have something to say in that story, and that's what I'm saying. Is really not about the plot. The plot is the vehicle for the change that the character has to make in order to achieve whatever goal that they set out to achieve. And that goal that they set out to achieve is something that they originally were afraid to go after. But some compelling new information comes to them. And this is basic Joseph Campbell stuff, you know, the mentor, the boom, whatever. I call it new information. And they say, oh, as afraid as I am, I do have to make this emotionally challenging decision to go after it anyway. You know, and so then they do, and they get into the river of the unknown and in Act Two. And, and shit happens, and they have to make internal adjustments, until they finally reach some paradigm shift, and they go into Act Three, and you know that's the basic structure. Now, let me just say, you're talking about new writers. I think that a new writer needs to learn that basic Campbellian structure before they try to do something really fancy, before they do a Pulp Fiction or and I think they should stick. This is for new writers now. I think they should stick with a single protagonist. I generally separate protagonist, which is an archetypal story function, story driver, from main character. Main character is the one that, from whose perspective we see the story. The main character is the one that actually carries the emotional thematic arc. They are often, in Hollywood, the same character. But there are times, like in Million Dollar Baby, where they are different.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying? Maggie drove that story in Million Dollar Baby, but the Frankie character was the change character. He's the one that carried the emotional arc. He's the one that had to make the emotionally challenging decisions. Maggie, there was no emotionally challenging decision. I want to be a boxer, and by God, I'm going to be the best. And that was it throughout the story until she was hurt. But Frankie, all the way through, yeah, and there are many reasons we won't get into analyzing that story, but there are many reasons why he was afraid to take her on as a boxer, why he was afraid to take her on again at the midpoint, et cetera, et cetera. Am I talking too much?
No, keep going. It's fantastic.
But generally, I think a new writer needs to combine those two aspects of character. Protagonist, which is the story driver, main character, which carries the emotional arc, make them a singular character, like Danny Caffey in A Few Good Men. He's both protagonist. He drives the story. He also has the emotional arc. He has to resolve his situation with his fear of being compared to his very famous father, litigating father. and he has to resolve that. And so he has an ally what's his name? The guy that's his assistant.
Kevin Pollak.
Yeah, I think. Is it Kevin Pollak?
Yeah, Kevin Pollak. Moore. The Demi Moore and Kevin Pollak characters.
No. Demi Moore is a conscience character.
Right.
She's the one that forces him, compels him to make the right choice. But the Kevin Pollak character, he's the one that corrects his mindset about his father.
Right, exactly.
So anyway, what I'm saying there is the protagonist and the main character are the same. You can't have them different. A new writer or someone who's, on their first, second, third script, they need to make sure they have the basic craft down, the fundamentals down. Then they can start, playing games with it.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of building a shack in your backyard before you go after a mansion or an office building.
Well, yeah. And also, if you get it from IKEA, you want to follow the directions.
Yeah, before you start getting fancy, you should probably follow the directions. And then once you follow the directions a lot and you understand the basics.
Yeah, yeah. I you see around me, you see all these bookshelves around. Well, I actually ordered 12 of those Billy Bob bookshelves or whatever you're calling them. Billy bookcases from IKEA. And so I built one. I followed the directions assiduously. Then I did the same thing with the second one. By the time I got to the third one, I knew what it was. By the time I got to the 12th one, I could build those things in 20 minutes.
Right, because you have experience already.
And that's exactly it. It's a craft. It's a craft. And you cannot become the artist until you, first of all, have got the craft in hand. That's true of anything. If you go to play the piano, you start – you learn your basic chords and scales and how to sight read. And later on, you start messing
getting
around.
Getting fancy. Get fancy. So I wanted to ask you in regards to a specific genre film, the revenge film. I was going to use that as an example. In the revenge film, generally speaking, there is no refusal of journey. Generally speaking, if you look at the Count of Monte Cristo, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but if you look at Count of Monte Cristo, it's not that he doesn't want to go, is that he's afraid to go or doesn't believe he could go, but the want, it's
You're
not that
by going, by talking, by going,
going,
break out of the cell.
Revenge, just generally revenge and going after that mission because once he gets into jail, it's about not about it, – it's revenge sits in the background, but it's about survival. It's about trying to get – and then when the moment appears that he can actually break out, even if it's as minuscule of an idea as that might be, great. And then that he sees that the old man can actually teach him all these things, and then revenge starts getting a little bit more coherent, but it's still a dream until he gets out, and then he finally goes – there's no refusal there, I don't think.
Well – I understand your point, and you could argue that he's a victim of that circumstance, and he could be giving up. There's no hope. There's no
right.
That could be considered as a refusal. But I'm glad you brought this point up though, because for me, generally, the refusal of the call is the beginning of the thematic journey. The refusal of the call, for instance, you get a call to adventure. We're talking Campbellian structure here, for anyone who's not aware of that. I mean, because a lot of people, there's a lot of talk about inciting incident, this and that. Inciting incident, call to adventure can be the same, but they can also be different.
Right.
The refusal of the call for me is the beginning of the thematic journey, because why would we refuse to go after something we want except for some underlying, perhaps unconscious, like in A Few Good Men, unconscious fear or emotional armor that we're protecting ourselves from? And then some new information comes along, and then we say, oh, damn, I've got to go after that. I've got to take that decision. And there are places. Yeah, I agree with you that there are successful movies that have no refusal of the call. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a missing beat that would have enhanced the story even more had they had that.
So what is the theme of A Monte Cristo then? Obviously revenge is the theme, but that's not a theme.
Revenge is
the subject matter. But the thing that how does Dante's change from, I mean, he obviously changes a lot from before he gets, thrown into jail and all that stuff to the end. But the thirst of revenge is like towards the end, he realizes, it's not worth it until he's drawn into the final battle.
Well, and that would be the thing. I mean, Hamlet's the same way.
Right.
Hamlet, he has that speech in Act 5, Scene 1 with Horatio, where, just let it be. Whatever will be, que sera, sera. He's watching, they dig up Yorick's skull and then they bury Ophelia and he's shocked. And he comes to, there's a providence in the fall of the sparrow. And then, in a sense, it's the same thing. There's another movie too. The Graduate.
Yeah.
You have Dustin Hoffman going after Catherine Ross and, he's banging on the windows, Catherine, right. And they run out of the church together. Mike Nichols touch. Because they rehearse that last bit where they're in the back of the bus. Remember that scene?
Of course.
It's an iconic scene. And the actors were so tired. They completed the beat. It was supposed to be a happy ending. But the actors were so tired, they thought the shot was over. And they just kind of let go. And they start looking at each other. Mike Nichols left that in because it's like, what now?
Right. Oh,
so it's what now?
Yeah.
What was the point of all of this? What now? And I think it's the same thing in Count of Monte Cristo. And what's the other one that I mentioned?
Well, I forgot the other one. But Kill Bill, let's use it because that's a very famous revenge film.
Yeah.
How does Kiddo change from the moment where she starts to where she is?
About the bride?
The bride. I think they called her name was Kiddo, I think, arguably. But the bride, yes, the bride. The bride.
Uma. Let's just call her Uma.
Uma. Let's call her Uma. Uma. Oprah. Oprah. Uma. No.
Oh, my God. wait. He never did that again, did he?
Never did that again. So, so Uma basically – at the end, I mean, that's just such a straight revenge film. There's no, even remember towards the end if she actually, I think she regretted it a little bit at the end. Like she was crying and this and that she had to.
No, I can't remember. Yeah. She, she loved this guy.
Right. And she had to kill him because of, spoiler alert, everybody. It's called Kill Bill. So, I mean, sorry, but she did love him, but yet still had to do it. And she didn't, I think towards the end, she didn't want, when she got to that moment, I think she didn't want to do it anymore. But I don't even remember if she had to,
again, this brings up Hamlet again, he's not really interested in killing anymore, but he's forced into this sword fight, fencing thing with Laertes. And so, and everyone winds up dying. And it's not his fault because he's already resolved his issue, with Claudius. So, like I said, I bring up Hangover again. There are, if you are adept as a storyteller, as Tarantino is, some movies aside, I never got through the Hateful Eight.
I'll go on record stating that's my least favorite of his films. I think it was just a lot of talky-talky. But like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I thought was brilliant. That was brilliant.
Well, yeah. Well, there are a lot of, you know, Pulp Fiction.
Oh, man. No, really. He's generally has a really good batting average in his career.
And in Glorious Bastards. I loved Inglorious Bastards. As a matter of fact, in our book, but the book that we wrote, the dialogue book you talked about.
Yeah, the dialogue book that you wrote with Linda.
I use that opening scene of the Nazi guy going into the. That's so a brilliant scene.
It's a master. It's a masterwork. Those 7 or 10 minutes is a masterwork of cinema. It's It is so good astounding. On so many levels. It's astounding how good it is. And he has those throughout his career. I mean, he is just such a unique voice in cinema. There has never been someone like him, nor I think will ever be anyone like him.
Well, he does pay homage to a lot of people that influenced him, or that he was influenced by.
Which is really interesting because which kind of brings me to another point. Paying homage. So if you watch the movie Point Break, which is a classic
I watched once and
I remember because it was during my generation's time. Like when I woke, I was a teenager.
There was a massive fight in a bar somewhere, right?
There was no bar fight. There was no bar fight in that movie.
Oh, really?
There was fights with alcohol around, but there was no bar fight. But that movie essentially was taken and completely paid homage to in Fast and Furious. So Fast and Furious is literally a blueprint from Point Break. I feel that's a little heavy-handed as far as like if you look at like it's the same other than you just switched out surfing for fast cars.
For
car racing. And then Fast and Furious turned into James Bond with cars. I mean, it's ridiculous now. But fun. But paying homage, how careful do you have to be? Because I think as a screenwriter, as storytellers, we're all taking from everything and everybody written. You know, and Tarantino, as much as he might be criticized for it, everything he does is original. He might take from other people, but he just mixes it. He's like a giant mixtape. He samples from everything and creates something completely new.
Well, and all artists do that. There's some famous quote that I've forgotten, but paraphrased. It's like we're all thieves.
Yeah, good artists copy, great artists steal.
There you go. There you go. And I've watched tons and tons and tons of movies in my time, and you don't know. Like for instance, I don't think George Harrison was consciously copying "He's So Fine" with his song "My Sweet Lord," but they won the copyright thing because I think there was like four notes that were the same. But I don't think he was consciously, but, you know, he was such a sponge for music that
something's going to pop out. Something's going to pop out.
Exactly. It will. Dylan used to take old folk songs and just rewrite them. You know, just rewrite the lyrics, you know, keep the melody. That's been done since time immemorial.
I mean, as screenwriters, especially young screenwriters starting out, I mean, obviously read as many screenplays as you can, watch as many movies as you can as a young screenwriter. Could you take structures from older films and kind of start using them as a starting point start using them as a starting point to get, because it's not, even if you start with like, I'm going to take Do the Right Thing. And I'm going to take its structure and I'm going to translate it to another language or another set of circumstances or another thing like that. But at the end, by the time you're done with it, it just naturally changes unless you're literally ripping off dialogue and scene by scene.
No. You can't do that. Structurally. I mean, songs do this all the time. You have a basic chord structure and you got your basic 1-6-2-5 chord structure, which in the 50s and 60s was used ubiquitously. As a matter of fact, I was just doing a song. Oh, I was playing the theme to The Apartment just yesterday, I think. Mm-hmm. And it is in a key of F, and it goes F, D minor, what was it? F, D minor, and then what's the fourth chord in F and C? No, C7, and then back to F. So it's a basic structure, but it's got this elaborate harmonies to it and melody to it that and you can do the same thing with screenplays. I did it with North by Northwest. I took North by Northwest beat by beat, and I just totally rewrote the whole thing. Different characters, different situations, different locations, certainly different dialogue, because my dialogue is funnier than
Hitchcock's. Yeah. Or whoever wrote that film, yes.
Yeah. That's a good place to start. But another place to start is just sit down and start writing, and then structure it after the fact.
Do you outline first, or do you just go?
Mostly I just go. I just start. Like, I have some impulse hits me. I can tell you two quick stories about screenplays I've written. John Denver, bought the farm back in 1997, I think. And my wife and I, a few weeks later, we drove up to Iowa City. She was a choreographer, and she was looking for music for her next gig. And so I was tooling around in the store, and I looked up at the billboards, top 10, top 100, whatever. And John Denver's three greatest hits albums were in the top 10, and his Christmas album was number 12. And I turned to my wife. I said, "Boy, this guy had to die, because he couldn't give his songs away the last 10 years of his life, primarily because of marital issues. You know, he married a." After Andy, he married somebody that was not supportive. Anyway, so I said, this guy had to die in order to make his, become famous again. And she looked at me, she said, "That's a screenplay." So, she just said that. I said, "What?" And so on the way home, we were talking about all kinds of Elvis sightings and things like that. And I wound up writing a story about an over-the-hill country western star who was uber famous, living in Bel Air, and they repossess his house, and he goes up in the mountains to talk to his manager, and everyone thinks he's dead, and he can't get back to L.A. for a reason I'm not going to get into, and winds up on a dude ranch shoveling horse shit for a living, because no one recognizes him. I'm not going to get into why. It's just he has a major car accident. He's out for 6 weeks, and they have to shave his head and then
his music starts blowing up again.
His movie starts blowing up, and so he has to get back to LA and cash in. But in the meantime, he's finding out who he really is instead of this facade. Another one was we owned some land in Iowa, and I was walking about 230 acres, all forests and fields, lots of briar patches, lots of berry bushes. And so I'm out there one day, and there's this huge briar patch. And instead of going around it, I said, I'm just going to go through it. And so I got in the middle of it, and I started getting hung up on the briars. You know, I was well-dressed. And all of a sudden, I couldn't move. And this little bit of panic went through my body. And in an instant, I had this whole story about a briar patch that eats people. And so I wrote that, and that's, become really popular, in the option world. So,
I wanted to also touch on that, because this is something that a lot of screenwriters don't understand about professional screenwriters in Hollywood, is that I know guys who have, have made one or two massive movies, like they were big, giant films, and yet when you go to their IMDb, they might have not had anything else produced for the next 10 or 15 years of their life. But they've been nonstop working for all of those times. And their scripts have been optioned left and right. And it gets optioned once, and then it gets optioned again, and it gets moved over to another studio. And they make a living off of things that never get produced. And can you talk a little bit about that kind of underground world that nobody really talks about?
I actually make most of my money or a lot of my money doing what I call vanity projects. People come to me and they want their life story on film and all of that, and you know, it's so unique and everything. No one lives a unique life. I mean, you talk about structure. All our lives are structured similarly.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, people come to me, they want a screenplay written, or, you know, a producer will come to me and want a screenplay written. And my spec scripts, I've had numerous options on. I've got about 15 spec scripts, 15, I don't know how many. And I've had numerous options on them because my writing is very contagious. You know, you start reading my script and you can't stop. There was a story. I was in Morocco doing a script for a producer, actually. And he was good friends with Ridley Scott. And he read one of my samples. Oh, actually, the one that I just talked to you about the Over the Hill Country Western Star, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which is basically a rom-com. So he was sitting there on the table. Ridley Scott was hanging with this guy over in Morocco, and not Bangladesh. What's the Marrakesh? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was going to go to bed, and Ridley says, "Can I take this to bed with me? You know, he just needed some reading material, something to put him to sleep."
That's all what you want to hear is like, "Ridley Scott took my script just to go to sleep."
Well. Interestingly, he comes down the next morning, he slams my script down on the table, and he says, "This damn thing kept me awake till 1 o'clock in the morning." And he says, "Is he fast?" And my producer said, "Yeah." Well, I'm still waiting for that phone call. But nevertheless, the point is that your writing style has to be contagious. It has to be don't get in the way of your story with your writing style. And I mean, that has to do with structure, character development, and also how you put the words on the page, period. Mm. So all of those things have to come together. What was the question? Do I just sit down and write, or do I?
No. The question was just to talk a little bit about the whole optioning and making a living.
So you can make a whole living without ever being on IMDb.
I've met so many of those screenwriters. Some of them literally have no IMDb credits or like one or two little ones. Yeah. And then there's other guys or gals who actually have one big credit, one monster credit. Yeah. And then silence.
Nothing.
Yeah. But in town, they're known as they're doing script doctoring. And that's a whole other script doctoring and that kind of world. Do you make a living doing that stuff?
Well, as a writer? John Sayles.
Oh,
he makes a living doctoring scripts, rewriting scripts. He makes, you know, a ton of money from the studios doing that, or used to. I don't know where he is now. And then he'll take that money and he'll go and make his own indie films, you know, and right. on, you know, you know, he basically, well, now he doesn't have to finance his own films, but yeah. And
Milius used to do that as well when he was an amazing script. I mean, he's an amazing script doctor. He wrote, I don't know if you knew this, he wrote the scene in Jaws when they're drunk right before that whole scene.
Oh, you mean on the boat?
In the boat.
Where they're getting south?
That's Milius.
Yeah,
Spielberg called him and like, "Can you do me a favor?" And he's like, "Sure, I'll write that scene for you." He wrote that scene like the night before.
Okay, so he's got his fingerprints all over that. Yeah.
Milius has his fingerprints all over all the movie brats stuff. He touched at one point or another.
Well, and the thing is guys like that, you know, if you give them a thank you, you know, they're fine with that. Just pay me, basically. It really is, you know, just I've got the skill, I've got the craft, you know, I got it down. Just, you know, pay me.
It's like gunslingers, basically. You're a gunslinger. Like, do you need me to clear out this outlaw for you in this town for you? I'm a mercenary.
Yeah. 5 easy pieces or a few dollars more.
Exactly.
Have gun will travel. That'll yes. be for your time.
Yes. Yeah. No, I remember those.
Paladin? You remember Paladin? You know, the Richard Boone character?
No, I did not. I don't remember that one. I've seen so much stuff, and especially I worked in a video store, so I saw a lot of stuff when
you
I was
and Jerry, you and Tarantino, huh? Yeah,
I was 5 years in a video store when all through like before high school and all through after high school, and then maybe a little bit after high school before I went to college. Yeah. I worked at a video store, so I watched. I was watching films at a time where I could literally watch everything released that week.
Oh,
you remember,
wow.
Can you remember, like, it was like, because they would release six movies a week.
Yeah.
I would watch all of that. That was a moment in time where you could actually do that. Now that's absolutely, I need multiple lifetimes just to catch up with what's existing right now. Now, I mean, you've worked with a lot of screenwriters in your time. What is the biggest mistake you see screenwriters, or especially young screenwriters, make?
Other than writing style?
Yes.
Other than using too many adverbs, too many passive verbs, and that sort of thing, which drives me crazy.
Yes.
Or overdoing your dialogue. It's another one. I'm listing a bunch of.
Go for it.
First of all, a screenplay is a lot like a short story, and people have to absorb that. It's not a novel. It's a short story.
Yes.
You know, you have to get it in under 2 hours, because that's about as long as the bladder lasts for your audience member. You know, seriously.
Yeah.
You know, and they need to sell more salt and sugar up in the
back when we used to be able to go to the movie theaters, not so much anymore. So we'll see where we're at
in
a year or so.
There are a bunch of them, and I talk about writing style because I used to say the same things over and over and over again. And I finally just wrote a book. And when somebody wants me to consult with them, I just send them the book, you know. But the other thing is not setting up the emotionally challenging decision that drives the story. I don't know if this is proprietary or not, but I talk about emotionally challenging decisions or dilemmas and decisions. And decisions of the main character are what drive the story, basically. And then you have a reaction from the antagonist, and so they have to reconsider and revise. And so the intention changes, but the objective remains the same. And those decisions are not well set up, and often people will put those major emotionally challenging decisions off screen somewhere, and you can't do that. You got to put it on the page. And also overwriting scenes, that's another one, you know. That's a technical issue.
So you mean to tell me there should be as little white space on the page as possible?
As little white, you know, put as much white space.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, this is a case in screenwriting. This is a case where less is definitely more, but you have to have the correct less. In
right.
other words, choose every single word.
I mean, I'll tell you, when I wrote, I mean, I've written screenplays in my career, but I read two nonfiction books. One was based on a story of my life, because my life was very interesting, sir. Thank you very much. But I found it so freeing writing a book, because I did not have to be so – I found it so much easier writing 60,000 words than it is writing whatever the amount of words is in a 90-minute screenplay, because in a screenplay you have to be so surgical.
Precise.
So surgical with your words, but in a novel you could just, and then he floated across the screen and he did this and that, and you could just like paint the, you could take a paragraph just to discuss how the wall looked, if the wall is really important. But in a screenplay, you've got three words to explain the wall.
No, that's the designer's job, designer and director.
Right, but in a novel,
okay, how can we make this wall important?
Right,
it's a character in the story, so how can we? You know, yeah. So, the way to do that, Alex, is I'm a big one for avoiding adverbs at all costs. And if you choose the correct action verb, you will not need an adverb. You will not need the modifier. Also, never, ever. I've written entire screenplays with not a single adverb, passive verb, helping verb, or passive present tense. And I challenge myself all the time. There are times when I'll spend an hour on a single sentence, you know, and believe me, I'm not shy about going to thesauruses and dictionaries, and I'll look all around. Next to songwriting and writing poetry within a particular form, screenwriting is right up there with those guys.
It's like the haiku of writing.
It is haiku. If you approach it like it's haiku,
yes,
you will get better. Absolutely. You cannot just sit there and splash ink on the page. You have to, you know, maybe that's good for to get your story out, but then go back and rework that damn thing.
I remember reading Shane Black's early screenplays, and the way he describes the scene, his descriptions were so vivid and so beautifully written and so concise. Yeah. It was wonderful. Then I read other scripts like that literally it's three or four paragraphs just to talk about like the alley. I'm like, dude, come, like, you need to move along here, guys. Like, the alley's not that, but in the writer's life, like, the alley is so,
yeah, I want to. The alley is for the location manager or the location scout.
Yeah. And that's something else I feel that a lot of young screenwriters make a mistake in, is that they feel that they're almost proxy directing. Oh. When they're writing, I mean, worst thing you could do is put a camera move in. Don't ever put a camera move in.
I just took that note this morning. Actually, I was working. I was consulting on a script, and I said, "Leave the directing to the director." I said, "You must acknowledge that you've got co-creators here, and you must lend them the space to do their work. Just all you do with the words is be as specific as possible." And then you let them expand upon it.
I mean, it's very similar, like, to an architect. The architect lays out the blueprint, but
the blueprint, exactly.
The blueprint is it's the foundation of everything. And as they're building the building, there's going to be a couple shifts here and there. And there's going to be in the guy who's paying for it. Isn't this the way it is in Hollywood? The guy who's putting up the money to finance this building is going to go, you know what? I want to move that wall over there. I want to paint it pink because my girlfriend wants it.
What he'll probably do is say, instead of making these studs 16 inches apart, can we make them 19 inches apart?
Right. Exactly. It's all the time. And then
against building code, but nevertheless,
right. And they'll start doing that. And then that's when the building just doesn't, it all comes crashing down. But
exactly. Well, and that's what happens in Hollywood. Right?
All the time.
A movie where the structure just absolutely sucks. Now, I'm not a big one to talk about structure up front because everything for me comes from character.
Right.
Even structure comes from character because you have this symbiotic relationship between plot and theme. But if all of these elements together don't cohere because a producer wants to throw in because his girlfriend is acting, oh, she can't do that. Can she do it this way? No, you can't. No, because it screws up your story. And I'm actually amending my words here. But it messes with the story. You can't do that, you know. Write another screenplay.
Right.
Don't use this one. God.
It happens all the time.
That's the thing. That's what happens in Hollywood, is they'll buy a property and then they'll totally jack it around and rewrite. They'll bring in their kitchen sink full of writers and no one's communicating with anybody else. It's like, you know.
Well, I mean, it depends on – I think the smart – I mean, look what Marvel did it the best as far as like they understand their properties and they have complete control. And this, and when they went away from their model early on, and you can see that in, I'm not sure how versed you are in the MCU, but the first film, I remember when Hulk came out, Ang Lee did a Hulk years ago with Eric Bana. And
remember that one?
Yeah, a little while ago when the visual effects really it didn't work out. Hulk looked horrible. But they let the director and the creative force rewrite the mythology of the Hulk. And it was this hodgepodge of craziness. He really was angry because of what his dad did to him and all this like super cycle. It was like, that's not the Hulk. We want to see Hulk smash. That's what we wanted to see. We want to see Hulk smash. We don't understand. Hulk smash. It's not complicated. But because all these other people came in, but then from that point on, they took control of their properties and kept going. But it happens.
But this goes back to our original topic of are there other stories other than the hero's journey?
Right.
And in this case, and I mentioned The Hangover and other things like that, where you tell a story purely for entertainment, you know. I have trouble getting on board with that, but you know.
Apparently not a lot of other people didn't, because it did very, very well in sponsor sequels.
No. I mean, it's a lot of movies. A lot of people just want, like my brother. So I asked my brother, I said, why do you go to the movies? He says, to escape. And okay, that's with the large demographic is I just want to go and let go of my life.
Well, I mean, absolutely. Yeah. But if you look at Hangover, I agree with you. They don't really change at all. I mean, there's not a change in the characters. They just go on an adventure, essentially.
But not only that, a lot of it wasn't funny to me. I mean, the whole Tyson
it's relative.
I could tear that thing apart, you know. But the funniest part to me actually was when the naked Vietnamese guy popped out of the truck. Yes. And that guy was funny.
He's so great. Chow was great. I mean, comedy is always relative. Some people will look at an airplane and go and Blazing Saddles and get offended.
Now you just mentioned two of my favorite.
Which they're amazing. They're two of the favorite. I mean Airplane is an absolute classic, and so is Blazing Saddles. But there's a lot of people who like my wife will watch Airplane. She's like, this is ridiculous. Why would I watch this? Like, she does not get it. And so comedy is also relative. But on a structural standpoint,
I'm still looking for the whacking material. I haven't found that section yet.
Or the chanting or non-chanting section, which is great with the Hare Krishnas. But if you look at Hangover 1, Hangover 2, and Hangover 3 are essentially the same movie.
I quit with Hangover 1.
But when I went to see Hangover 2, which was basically Hangover 1 but in Thailand, it was all it was. It was just the exact same story. Yeah,
Alex, it's because the audience loved Hangover 1. They loved that structure. So let's give it to them again.
Absolutely. But that same director then wrote and directed Joker, which was arguably one of the better films in the comic book genre, in my opinion. I don't know what you felt about Joker.
I haven't seen it.
So Joker is basically Taxi Driver. It's Taxi Driver, but with a comic book villain. And he's Travis Brickle, to the point where they hired Travis Brickle to be in the movie. So Robert De Niro's in the movie, and Scorsese was going to originally produce it. He had to walk away from other because he had other projects. But I mean, it was so involved. So if you haven't seen Joker yet, you should watch Joker purely because it's Taxi Driver. That's why people were losing their mind. People were like, "This is," because if you release Taxi Driver today,
wasn't that disguised.
Oh, I mean. So anybody who's ever seen Taxi Driver could go, oh, this takes place in the 70s. He's not literally a taxi driver, but the themes, everything, the aesthetic.
The psychotic
the psychotic breakdown, the aesthetics of how it's shot. It is so clearly Taxi Driver, and they make no bones about it. They're like, oh yeah, we were completely inspired by it was a combination of King of Comedy and Taxi Driver. It's a mesh of those two.
Okay, I'll go watch it.
By the way,
speaking of Taxi Driver, you know, the title of our book is You Talking to Me. Mm-hmm. And the thing is it's a book about dialogue, how to write dialogue.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm big reveal here, that line was improvised.
Yeah, I know.
It wasn't written.
the funny thing is, one of my friends who passed away, he was the first AD, I think it was the first AD or the UPM on Taxi Driver, and he was in the room when they did that.
Okay, so you know the story.
He told me the story. He's like, yeah, that was just like the kind of Marty just kind of went off.
Scorsese hasn't written it. No, it's Scorsese asked De Niro. He says, we need something with the mirror. Can you improvise something? And so, yeah. And as a matter of fact, they did it once, and the gun mechanism didn't work.
Right.
And so they had to do it again.
Yeah. It was – no, it's – but those are the things that people also – a lot of screenwriters also think that like, oh, that was a genius writing. Like, no, a lot of times they do come up with it on the set.
Well, now, here's the thing. If I were directing something that I had written – we would, first of all, have a lot of table reads, and I would make sure that the script is ironed out. See, because I'm from the theater now.
Yeah.
And I've done Shakespeare, and I've done Sam Shepard, and I've done all of these, you know, things in between. And I would want them to nail down the dialogue before we go in front of the camera. I don't want people, you know, let's make sure that we have it, and we know what our beats are, and we know what our motives and intentions are, and let's do it right. If you're good actors, I've worked with those actors who say, "Oh, I don't want to mess up my creative thing." Well, I would just say, go back to acting school.
Agreed. Actors need, but like structure and understanding the craft, you need to understand the basics first, but have some leeway to play.
Well, no, okay. I'll tell you something. I watched, interestingly enough, I don't know how well touted Jennifer Aniston is, but I saw some outtakes of her doing the same scene over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. She stuck to the script exactly, but every single take was different.
Yeah, she just presented it differently. Now,
that's great skill. Mm-hmm. No, I think that she's in the moment. I think she's right there in that moment. And that's what was it Sanford Meisner or somebody who says that a great actor, no, it's Antonin Artaud, the French crazy guy, mm-hmm. who wrote Theater in His Double. He said a great actor is one who is able to repeat a moment as if for the first time. And that's what I'm getting at. If the line doesn't work, let's fix the line. But then when you're in front of the camera, by God, deliver.
You know, right, exactly. But with that said, there's also those magical moments that you can't write, like in Midnight Cowboy crossing the street. I'm walking here.
Yeah.
You can't write that. And then was a taxi, and he's like waving his hand. It's brilliant.
We actually had the same Bible on that.
Absolutely.
That was absolutely. And a lot of people don't know that that was an ad lib. That taxi driver was real.
he almost ran over Dustin Hoffman and John Voight. It was just.
But he stayed right in character, though. I mean, it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. Yeah.
I know we could keep talking for at least another 2-3 hours. But I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What are 3 screenplays every screenwriter should read?
Oh my God, I have no idea. I don't know.
Pick 3 of your favorite screenplays, any of them.
Boy. Chinatown is a good one for me.
Hangover, obviously.
Yeah, you got that one. Chinatown.
If you can't come up with any other ones, that's fine.
I mean, I've got so many of them that I don't want to, like.
I mean, it's not going to be on your gravestone. You could just spurt out 3 names. It's fine.
Butch Cassidy, and back in the day, you know, William Goldman was a go-to guy. And I constantly quote one of his or explain one of his scenes about, you know, Sundance not wanting to jump off that cliff, but he has to make the emotionally challenging decision, not because he's afraid of dying, because he's afraid of humiliating himself, which I think is just a brilliant, brilliant choice, for an actor to make. Mm-hmm, You know, that was emotional. That's when I talk about emotionally challenging decisions, that's one of the things I talk about. It's fear of death. Is less than the fear of public speaking or
humiliation. Know, yeah.
Humiliating yourself. Yeah. So, oh God, what, I think A Few Good Men is a good.
Oh, good such script. A crazy. But Sorkin. Yeah, Sorkin.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend Godfather only because Coppola did his own thing. And I think for a new writer, it would be, you know, it would take them off in a track they can't quite follow.
Well, it's kind of like studying, you know, Beethoven and Mozart at the start.
Yeah.
Before,
let's start with the baby stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Let's start reading Hangover first, and then we'll go into The Godfather.
Hangover would be a distraction. Look around. Hold a second.
No, we got him. We got it.
Well, no, I gave it to I did copy North by Northwest, but I totally changed it. Contemporary. Yeah. Well, my agent at the time, he said, take an old classic and then contemporize it and disguise it. And then so I had another very close friend say, oh, do North by Northwest. And so I did. And I think that's a
those are three great starting points.
All right. Okay. So I'll leave it at that.
Now, what advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
What advice would I give them?
Yes.
Well, what you just said, read lots of screenplays, watch lots of movies, but read all the beginning books, you know, and read, I would suggest, other than for the first two books I suggest for new writers is Vogler's book and David Trottier's book, and read Linda's book too. Read Linda's Making a Good Script Great.
Yep.
Read those three. You can read the Sid Field book and the Michael Haig book, but also, in conjunction with those books, also study Dara Mark's book, Inside Story, because it's all about character, 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 mm-hmm. character. Dara and I feel the same, that everything in a story comes from character. You name me something and I will track it all the way back to character. The only thing that doesn't is outside the story is genre. That's the mood, the tone, the pace. And a good example of that is, Dr. Anton Chekhov was.
Yeah.
And he wrote four great plays, you know, Seagull, Cherry Orchard, Three Sisters, and Uncle Vanya, and a bunch of one acts. And he wrote them as social satires. They were social satires. And Stanislavski read them. And Konstantin Stanislavski read them. He says, no, these are not satires. These are tragedies. And so, and the rest is history. He produced them as tragedies instead of as social. But what I would love to do is take those plays and direct them as social satires.
Okay.
But anyway, the point I'm making is that everything comes from character except possibly genre.
Now, what lesson took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Letting go.
Yes.
Just realizing that you cannot, and I actually, my father said this when I was 11 or 12 years old, but I didn't get it until many years of actually teaching piano and also consulting on screenplays, that you cannot teach anything. You can facilitate another person's learning when they are ready to learn it.
That's good.
And even then, you have to be able to – I think the true gift of a teacher is understanding what doors are open that you can enter and what knowledge can be dispensed as a result that will build upon what's already known. But you cannot teach – and you cannot impose knowledge on anyone. That's the biggest thing I had to learn. That's great. In other words, in my obsessive compulsive manner, I had to learn to let go of needing to get other people to get something.
Fair enough. And where can people find you and your work and your new book that you wrote with Linda?
Well, the book is on Amazon.
and the name of the book again?
You Talking to Me? Mm-hmm. How to Write Great Dialogue. And they can find me at johnwinstonrainey.com. And what else?
That pretty much covers it. And you do script consulting and
consulting, analysis, but those are not the real fun things. The fun thing is just writing a good screenplay.
Fair enough.
And I do that on, people hire me all the time to write a screenplay, and I'm pretty fast.
All right.
And I'm still not in the union by design, by choice, because I can charge whatever I want to charge.
Fair enough. John, thank you so much for being on the show and dropping the knowledge bombs on the tribe today. I appreciate it, my friend.
Well, it was a joy. It was absolute joy. I hope it works for you.
I want to thank John for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you so much, John. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including links to his books, You Talking to Me, How to Write Great Dialogue and Screenwriting Style That Sizzles, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/093. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, keep on writing no matter what. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.